Radio Netherlands Vox Humana presents Becoming Rebecca West.
Early this year, I got an email from theater producer Paul Lucas, who I'd met in New York City a few years back, about a production he was bringing to Amsterdam called That Woman, Rebecca West Remembers. The name didn't ring a bell, so I did what I often do these days. I went to the internet and Googled Rebecca West. Interesting. Journalist, novelist, critic. Born in London, 1892. At 14, wrote a letter to a newspaper in defense of suffragettes. Wrote her first novel at 18. Became H.G. Wells' lover at 20. And had a son, Anthony, out of wedlock. By the age of 30, was being hailed as George Bernard Shaw in Skirts. Did a lecture tour of America and had an affair with Charlie Chaplin. Wrote a 1,500-page book about Yugoslavia before World War II. And after, covered the Nuremberg trials. In 1949, Time magazine called her the number one woman's writer in the world, and she played a role in Warren Beatty's film Reds. I'd never heard of Rebecca West, but her extraordinary life spanned almost the whole 20th century. I decided to see the play.
I think everyone should have lunch with Warren Beatty. The most attractive man I've ever met. He's making a film about Jack Reed and Louise Bryant. I knew Bryant. Very pretty woman. No brain, of course, but very pretty woman. He asked me about my sex life. Cheek. I'm nearly 90. I told him I had some time free Thursday afternoon.
My name is Helen MacLeod and I'm Rebecca West's great niece. Her sister was my grandmother, my father's mother, and I knew her until she died when I was 17. Actually, my first memory of her is that I thought I'd murdered her husband, Uncle Henry. When I was 2, they came for Christmas at my house in Edinburgh, and my mum was busy cooking Christmas dinner for 12 adults and 6 children, and Uncle Henry used to wear very beautiful tailored Savile Row suits, bespoke suits, anyway. So he was bouncing me on his knee just before we went into Christmas dinner, and I got a little overexcited and I peed on him. And there was a huge fuss about it because they had to delay dinner and my mum had to sponge down this incredibly expensive special suit. And so I really got freaked out. I thought I'd done something, you know, really, really terrible. And about 8 months later, he died. So I was convinced that I'd killed him and that Aunt Rebecca would, you know, definitely have it out with me. So I remember being quite scared of her from an early age.
I was 18 years old. And not yet Rebecca West. Now, that all started because I wrote an article attacking an anti-feminist, and to my horror, I got a letter saying suddenly, would I please telephone them? They wanted to put my name on the advertisements. C.I. Fairfield. Now, that was my name, my real name, Cicely Isabel Fairfield. It's a quite impossible name unless you have bright blue eyes and long ringlets, and I had neither. Now, my mother had forbidden me to read The Free Woman, and her shock at finding her daughter was a contributor would be great indeed, given the fallout from my little letter in The Scotsman. So I needed a nom de plume, and I was in a hurry, and I said, Rebecca West. The heroine of Ibsen's play Rosmersholm.
My first idea when I was first thinking about this was talking to an actress about becoming Rebecca West.
Right.
But in a sense, she became Rebecca West herself, didn't
yeah.
she?
Oh, absolutely. I think that it's very important to remember that one of her first loves was acting. I think she would have loved to have been on the stage, and I think that she was, to some degree, playing a part. But if you think about it, it was because there were no role models in real life. There are women in fiction who are strong and clever and influential, but there were very few in actual life. So she had to write a role for herself and then fill it. But I never discussed it with her. I think that the whole idea of her taking on the name of a character from a play was quite intriguing, and that she was a very dramatic person. She tended to rewrite her own personal history, and I think it had a lot to do with that. And I think that my father and my mother sort of almost ignored it, you know, and it was she was Aunt Sissy to us, and you know, and that was that. But especially after I started becoming a writer myself, or deciding to be a writer, I liked her as Rebecca, and I called her Aunt Rebecca, and I think she liked that, actually.
My name is Anne Bobby, and I am the actress who is portraying Rebecca West in Rebecca West Remembers, as well as one of the co-writers. I first heard of Rebecca West actually through Helen McLeod, who is a friend of Paul Lucas, and I'm also a friend of Paul Lucas. Paul and I did theater together, summer stock, when we were very young. And Helen used to live in the same building as Paul, and eventually he put the three of us together in one room. And Paul said, "Oh, Helen is Rebecca West's great niece." And I went, "Okay, I don't know who Rebecca West is, but Helen started telling me about her, and I started to look her up on the internet, and I started to read about her life, and read Carl Rawlison's excellent biography of Rebecca West. And I really got extremely drawn to this character, this woman, and the idea of playing her didn't really occur to me until Helen's father, Norman, who was Rebecca's nephew, came to visit Helen for a time, and over a dinner he said, "You know, you should really play Rebecca." And I was like, "Oh, really?" And that's how it all started.
Writers on the subject of August Strindberg have hitherto omitted to mention that he could not write. H.G. Wells's books get longer and longer. Someday the parlor maid, pushing back the study door against the rising tide of manuscript, will discover the distinguished author suffocated by the proof sheets of his new novel.
How important was H.G. Wells in the woman Rebecca West became?
I think he was enormously important to her development. And I think that the fact that she could hook someone of that caliber, I mean, he really was a huge star. And the idea that she, at 20, at 19, could be so fascinating and attractive and intellectually powerful to take on somebody like that, more or less as an equal, certainly on an intellectual basis, I think that must have really had a big impact on her. It must have given her enormous confidence and momentum. But then on the other hand, of course, he drove her nuts and was responsible for her not having the early literary career, or not the early recognition that she really could have and should have had if she'd stayed in London. And that's why when she got rid of him and went to America, it was a huge unleashing of energy and power.
Dear H.G., over the next few days, I shall either put a bullet through my head or commit something more shattering to myself than death. At any rate, I shall be quite a different person. I refuse to be cheated out of my deathbed scene. Dear H.G., I don't understand how you wanted me 3 months ago and don't want me now. I wish I knew why that was so. Dear H.G., of course you're quite right. I haven't anything to give you. You have only a passion for excitement and comfort. You don't want any more excitement, and I don't give people comfort. I never nurse them except when they're very ill. I carry this to excess. On reflection, I can imagine the occasion on which my mother found me most helpful to live with was when I helped her out of a burning house. I always knew that you would hurt me to death one day, but I had hoped to choose the time and place. I've always been at a loss when I meet hostility, because I can love, and I can do practically nothing else. You've always been unconsciously hostile to me, and I have not tried to conciliate you by transforming my love for you, hacking away at my love until it was the thing that you most wanted. You have literally ruined me. I am burned down to my foundations. I may build myself up again, or I may not. You say obsessions are curable. They are, but people like me swing themselves from one passion to the next, and if they miss, smash down somewhere where there aren't any passions at all, but only bare boards and sawdust. You once found my willingness to love you a beautiful and courageous thing. I still think it was. I would give my whole life to feel your arms around me again. I wish you loved me. I wish you liked me. Yours, Rebecca.
She is truly ahead of her time as a feminist. Even then, she had such a deep... Well, one of her most famous lines is, I've yet to figure out precisely what feminism is. I only know that people have called me a feminist whenever I seem to express sentiments that differentiate me from a doormat or a prostitute. And, she was well aware of the fact that feminists were headed for an uphill battle. And, you know, look at what's happening in the world. That battle is, you know, I don't know what the female version of Sisyphus would be, but that is the feminine struggle. And at the same time, she could be so bitterly dismissive of women, you know, comparing American women, you know, there were very few good-looking women my age. Almost every woman, not theatrical, who spoke to me wore an untidily arranged hairnet dragging across her forehead. Oh, yes, their complete and utter lack of sex attraction was simply terrifying. Ow! Hey, aren't we all in this together? Come on. But she did not suffer fools gladly, and she had no patience with anyone who would try and rest on their laurels. What a feminist.
She was a very intimidating person, and she had been quite unkind to my older brother and sister. So by the time I was sort of thrown into the moor, we used to be taken for visits at her flat in Knightsbridge, and it was a very intimidating sort of, oh my God, we're going to see her, Aunt Rebecca. And but when I turned about 15, she and I had a really great conversation about, I'd just got my nose pierced. And she was just hilarious about it and said that it didn't go with my demure haircut, I should get a different haircut or whatever. So we ended up being able to talk about a lot of things. I mean, she would tell me funny stories, like she told me the story about Charlie Chaplin and her breaking into the Central Park boathouse and nearly being arrested. That's how come it's in the play.
When I heard about Rebecca West's incredible power of attraction to some of the really great personas of the day, it really didn't surprise me that much. I think that at the time, a woman of her intelligence and a woman of her incredible charisma, I mean, her charisma comes through in her photographs even now, I think that that was very exotic still to, you know, this was the beginning of the film industry, you know, actresses were scandalous. And here was this incredibly composed, highly intelligent woman taking her first tour of America hot on the heels of her gossip. You know, H.G. Wells's mistress is coming to America. Oh boy, oh boy, oh boy. And, you know, and I think that men were just so drawn to her. I mean, Alex Wolcott and the Algonquin Round Table and Paul Robeson, Charlie Chaplin, it makes perfect sense to me. It really does. I would like to go a little bit further into that and find out about, oh, the Barrymores and, you know, just see who else. But no, it doesn't surprise me. She was a force.
I felt in my prime when Harold Ross asked me to cover the Nuremberg trials for the New Yorker. I arrived late in the trials. An avenging angel. Ross was having a ghastly time of it, as the dispatches from Nuremberg were weak. Now, this was not because there was no drama to report, but because the whole affair was being dominated by Goering. He was like a madam in a brothel, bullying and manipulating everyone until the prosecution was running in circles. I was judged sufficiently intimidating to take him on.
I think she was deeply concerned about the way the world is and was, and she had a huge capacity for moral outrage, which she would then use her powers to unleash her opinions about things. And I think she probably did change a few things. I think that she was instrumental in perhaps getting some people to see that Stalin, for instance, was a mass murderer and a bad thing. And I think it started early with her, just seeing this fundamental unfairness of women being disenfranchised. I think that taught her early to see that there were things that were wrong and then they could change, and that we have the power to change things through writing. And I think she really made that her business. And the Yugoslavia book is an amazing book. It's often been described as one of the most important books of the 20th century. And I think the reason for that is that she is so good at analysing the causes of mass sources of human unhappiness, this love of ugliness, this divided self where half of us loves pleasure and half of us wants to be involved in catastrophes. Why would we want that? And she has a lot to say about that being the case and needing to watch out for it and watch out for its consequences.
In Macedonia, our car struggled up a stretch of pasture till it could go no further. We were so near the rock that we could see its colour. It was a flat-topped rock, uneven in shape, rising to something like 6 feet above the ground, and it was red-brown and gleaming, for it was entirely covered with the blood of the beasts that had been sacrificed on it during the night. When we came nearer the rock, we had to pick our way among a number of bleeding cocks' heads. The spectacle was extremely disgusting. The colour of spilt blood is not properly a colour. It is in itself discoloured. It is a visible display of putrescence. It would have been pleasant to turn round and run back to the car and drive away as quickly as possible, but the place had enormous authority. I noticed that the man who had been settling a child on a rug was now walking round the rock with a black lamb struggling in his arms. He made the circle 3 times and stopped, then bent and kissed the greasy, blood-stained rock. Now the gypsy fetched the child. It was a little girl of 18 months or so. Her father handed her up to another man and then climbed up himself. Now the man who was holding the lamb took it to the edge of the rock and drew a knife across its throat. A jet of blood spurted out and fell red and shining on the browner blood that had been shed before. The gypsy had caught some on his fingers, and with this he made a circle on the child's forehead. Then he got down again and went round the rock another 3 times, carrying another black lamb. "He is doing this," a bearded Muslim standing by explained, "because his wife got this child by coming here and giving a lamb, and all children that are got from the rock must be brought back and marked with the sign of the rock. Many women had got children by giving cocks and lambs to the rock. One woman who had come all the way from Prilep had had a child after living in barren marriage for 15 years. It was a huge and dirty lie. Women do not get children by adding to the normal act of copulation the slaughter of a lamb, the breaking of a jar, the decapitation of a cock, the dragging of wool through blood and grease. If there was a woman whose fertility could be unsealed by witnessing a petty and pointless act of violence, by seeing a jet of blood fall from a lamb's throat onto a rock wet and stale with stinking blood, her fertility would be the reverse of motherhood. She would have children for the purpose of hating them. I knew this rock well. I had lived under the shadow of it all my life. All our Western thought is founded on this repulsive pretense that pain is the proper price of any good thing.
What was she looking for in Yugoslavia, and did she find it?
I think she was looking for some understanding about conflict and the shape of history. And I think she did find some of it. I think she had... She liked the Serbs because they all reminded her of her father. So to some degree, I think she was looking for her father. She was looking for a kind of romantic ideal. But I do think that she found something very profound there. I think she basically had a love affair with a whole country from which both of them benefited. I think it's difficult to say what she was after. But I think just as usual, understanding, insight, even in the smallest details, just finding clues to try and piece it all together.
How do you piece together an extraordinary life of 90 years like this into a little under an hour and a half?
The answer to that question is we haven't. it's very difficult, but what we've allowed ourselves to do is to be in that state where we admit that it is impossible, precisely because she was such an extraordinary person and she was so diverse in her talent. She was a critic and a novelist and a letter writer and, a lecturer and all sorts of different things, and the subject matter she covered were very wide-ranging and her relationships were incredibly chaotic and all over the place.
In 1955, Anthony published a novel, Heritage. He said it was going to be a light book. In it, I figured as an irresponsible actress who neglects her darling little boy. I wanted to write a novel about an actress who drowns her darling little boy.
She never talked about Anthony to me, and she preferred not to talk about him at all. They were completely estranged for at least the last 20 years of her life. And my father was one of the last people to see her compos mentis. She had a stroke and took about 3 months to die, but he saw her, really when she, the last time she was actually speaking. And the last words he ever heard her say were, "Oh, that dreadful, dreadful boy." And it just ate her up. It was the catastrophe of her life. It's such a shame. And we tried to give some sense of that in the play, but it's something that we'd almost like to emphasize because it really tore her apart, the fact that she could be so insightful in human, human emotions and human dealings with each other, and yet not be able to figure out how to have any kind of good relationship with her own son. It's very sad.
In your own career as a writer, do you always feel like you have to sort of bring yourself up to her level, or is she an intimidating role model?
No, she's a great role model because she had a wonderful capacity to range across a wide range of subjects and weave them all together, and that's something that I'm very interested in. So I find her inspirational, particularly her non-fiction. And she also tried to discourage me from going to study English literature at university because she said it wouldn't be a good idea if I wanted to be a writer. But I defied her and went anyway, so. But she was always extremely entertaining and very strident, and I think she had a brain the size of a planet, and she could look at things from a very commanding point of view that people with lesser brains can't. And so I often invoke her when I'm writing my journalism or other nonfiction in particular, trying to get that kind of clarity and appetite for analysing things.
What has becoming Rebecca West on stage over the past year or so done for you?
I see playing Rebecca West as a tremendous honor, and I learn from her every day. She has forever changed the way I look at men and women. I think that the thing I carry with me most is just how important it is to persevere with your ideas and your goals and your work, your dreams, that no one's going to sort of kick open the door and spread out the welcome mat. You've got to break the door down more often than not, as she did. And I am very, very aware of how we in this century still face a lot of adversity as far as creativity and vision is concerned. And I find that she is an invaluable individual to apply the experience to. Her life is a lesson that everyone could benefit from.
Not thinking in terms of her being, if she were alive today, 110, but if she were around, what would she be doing today?
I think she'd be ripping the intestines out of George Bush in the press. I think she would be giving Tony Blair hell. I think she would be telling it like it is, and would be very entertaining at the same time. She'd probably have rap stars coming round for lunch and be going off and making documentaries or whatever. I think she was a woman way ahead of her time, and I miss her being around now to comment on what's going on, because I think she'd have a lot of very insightful things to say about it.
The odd thing about being 90 is that there is no continuity in the business. It's not that you have any fears you're going to die, it's that your upholstery is already dead around you. Now, the trouble with being old is the accumulated load of knowledge and how to bring it to bear on current circumstances. On my better days, I see that the new country I fought for, wrote for, hoped for, has long since arrived, and is in fact grown up with children of its own, women born with the vote into a world of opportunity and much, much better sanitary towels. But I see this all from the old country. My nose to the streaky glass. Oh, I'm allowed to visit the new country, to enjoy the trappings my past and my celebrity have afforded me, to have Warren Beatty pour my tea. But in the end, no one wants to hear that relations between men and women have not changed. Criticism, not condemnation. And so I am dispatched back to the old country, a totem on a shelf, mingling with the ghosts of those who keep me there, who set me there to begin with. But just as my beloved Yugoslavia called out to me from another old country, so will I wait for a new country to take me down from the shelf and claim me.
Becoming Rebecca West featured writer Helen McLeod and actress Anne Bobby. Special thanks to Paul Lucas, producer of Rebecca West Remembers, and Xaviera Hollander, who brought the production to the Netherlands. The program was produced by David Swatling with sound engineer Rob Hirschop. Vox Humana is a Radio Netherlands presentation.